New world sports, new world trials for new world courts, new world lawyers and new world laws, new world prisons and new world bars, new world fight, the new world fist, new world lighting up the new world split. Good afternoon. This is Michael Stone, your host for Conversations. We have a very special show today, a Peace Paradigm show. I'm very excited about the guests we have, and I'm just going to welcome them and give you a little overview. First of all, we have Sarah Ruth Van Gelder, who is the co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine, a journal of positive futures which explores possibilities and practical steps towards a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. Sarah's deep and insightful interviews highlight the leadership coming from grassroots communities, social movements, and activists who are building a future that can work for all. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Michael.
Great to have you here. Our second guest is Dr. David C. Corton, author, teacher, publisher, and lecturer. David has over 35 years of experience in preeminent business, academic, and international development institutions. He's the author of the international bestseller, When Corporations Rule the World, and his most recent book is The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. Welcome, David. It's good to have you.
Yeah, good to be back on your show, Michael.
Always a pleasure. And Dot Maver, who is the president and CEO of Peace Partnership International, which works to forge alliances with government, business, and civil society to co-create a culture of peace. Dot served as the national campaign manager for the 2004 Denis Kucinich for President campaign. She is a founder of the Center for Cooperative Principles, one of the co-founding members of the Vermont Peace Academy, and serves as coordinator of Share the Spirit of Peace Global Summits. So welcome, Dot.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be with you.
It's very good. What a wonderful combination we have. And as I said, we're going to be doing a special today to really delve into what I think is the most important subject that we've ever gone over. Of course, we've done things on PSD and other areas, but we want to take a comprehensive look at the peace possibility that's arising out of much of the change that's happening in our world. Before we go there, I'd like to start with a short overview of where we are. I'm going to just give you some numbers so that we have a sense of the reality of this situation in terms of the costs of this war that we have going on now, or double war, I should say, between Iraq and Afghanistan. Of all the military spending in the entire planet, 47% is spent by the U.S., In 2009, the U.S. has requested a military spending budget of $6 to $7 billion. In 2001, it was $325 billion. The military spending of the next top 10 countries is $446 billion, just to give you a contrast. The monthly cost of the Iraq war right now is $12.5 billion. And that's the cost that's put out by our government. But if you have had the opportunity to read The $3 Trillion War by Joseph Stiglitz and Linda J. Blimes, the real cost is including the health and all the other impacts, the externalized costs on our society, is more like $3 trillion. 81% of Americans say we're headed in the wrong direction. In terms of deaths, Americans wounded, the official estimate is 30,500. Documented civilian deaths in Iraq are estimated at 85 to 150,000. The U.S. policy is we don't do body counts, but we're talking at least 150,000, 85 to 150,000 people. 21% of all Iraqi households have lost at least one family member, which if you add that up, since 2003, the total comes to 1,033,239. There's no official world count on that. What we do know is that approximately 2.4 million Iraqis have fled their homes for safety. 1.5 million are living in Syria and 1 million in Jordan in addition. Another million living in Jordan, Iran, Egypt, and Lebanon. The Army says they're not tracking wounded, but the low estimates are in excess of 30,000. One of the things I'd like to talk about on this show is the phenomena, which we have addressed before, of post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, which is a disabling anxiety disorder. I believe it's a social time bomb that we are not paying enough attention to, and that the estimates range on the low side between 20% and the high side, which actually is unofficial from the Veterans Department, of 40% of the 1.5 million troops serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's somewhere between 300 and 600,000 people in our society are now diagnosable with PTSD. In terms of tax allocation, our military spending of our tax dollar is 43%, but that's not the whole story. The debt service on the military is another 11%. So of our tax money right now, we are spending 54% of all of our money. Compare that to science, energy, and environment, 3%, social programs, 3%, government operations, 7%, education, 6.3%, and health, 5%. Our current federal debt is now at $9.4 trillion. A little bit about war and money. The world spends some $1,000 billion annually on the military. Between 1999 and 2006, the U.S. sold $79.53 billion to developing countries. 64.4% of its total arms sales. In 2006, the U.S. sold 39% of the world's arms. The closest country to that was Russia with 17%. Most of the others are far under 10%. That's only accounting for the legal sales. One of the other things that many people are not aware of is that the American public pays between $6 and $7 billion annually in subsidies to the arms makers to market and finance these sales. On top of that, we bear the cost of all the research and developing these weapons in the first place. So I just wanted to go over some of those numbers to get us started. And what I'd like to do is take a few minutes for each of us to give a little overview of where we see the world view right now. What's your sense of the world? And Sarah, let's start with you. You had a wonderful magazine, Yes, publication in the summer called Superpowers, Get Over It. And I highly recommend people can go online and find those articles at yesmagazine.org. So Sarah, can you give us a kind of overview of where you see our current state of the world?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Michael, and thank you for all of those statistics. You certainly
it's a little overwhelming, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. You know, we might think of, or historians might look back at this era as the last decade of the American superpower. You can say an empire or a superpower has several things it has to have in order to function. One is a very strong military, and as you mentioned, we're spending an awful lot of money on our military, but our military now is so committed trying to cope with insurgencies in both Iraq and Afghanistan that it stretched very thin, and that became very obvious during the recent invasion in Georgia when it was very clear that the United States really didn't have the military capacity to respond if we chose to do so. The second is a strong economy, and our economy is, as I think most people are aware in their daily lives, is in serious problems. At the national level, we have this enormous budget deficit that grows every year. We're borrowing to maintain our current level of spending, both as a federal government, but also our trade balance is way out of whack, and we borrow every year from China and countries in the Middle East just to keep on being able to consume at the level we're consuming now. And, of course, individual American consumers who have been the engine of the economy are way in debt. So our economy has some very, very serious structural problems that will be with us for some time to come. And then the third area that I think any empire needs to maintain its standing is a moral standing or a sense of legitimacy. And it's really remarkable when you think of the days after 9/11 when the entire world was with the United States and even France was saying, you know, we're all Americans now, where there was, you know, basically a small group of criminals, the Al-Qaeda network and a few supporters who were against the United States, but everybody else in the world was with us. And how that has almost completely reversed, so that because of the policies of the Bush administration and the invasion of Iraq, the illegal invasion of Iraq, and the subsequent mismanagement of the occupation, our moral standing and our sense of legitimacy around the world has dived to extremely low numbers. So all these three factors that go into making an empire or a superpower a viable power in the world have really been undermined in the last few years. And I think we're going to be seeing now the transition to a post-empire, post-superpower world. And the question is, how do we want to manage that?
Yes.
We could be a very dangerous force in the world if we manage that, you know, trying to cling on to being the ultimate power, or we could be a very productive force in the world if we choose, as citizens of this superpower, to make the transition gracefully to being part of a community of nations.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That's wonderful. David.
Yeah, that's a great start. I want to put this whole discussion in a yet larger global context. I look at this as a defining moment for the human species. It is a time in which we must very explicitly choose our future, and in which the circumstances compel us to do some rather fundamental rethinking of our priorities. And I look at our current situation in terms of a threefold crisis. First of all, we are overconsuming. We're consuming Earth's resources faster than they can regenerate, leading toward a planetary environmental collapse. We face growing inequality in the world, which is stressing our social systems to the limits and threatens social collapse. And third, we are governed by a set of institutions that are basically devoted to increasing consumption and inequality. You know, it is so striking that we've chosen to measure our human progress by gross domestic product, which, if you really take it apart and look at it more deeply, is measuring the rate at which we're converting the useful resources of the planet into toxic garbage to make money for already rich people. Basically an act of insanity. So we've actually created a global system that is undermining well-being. Now, this can be a source of considerable fear, or we can recognize that it is, in fact, a moment of extraordinary opportunity for bold action to rethink our priorities and to make bold commitments to creating the world that we want. And picking up on where Sarah left off, you know, for the United States, it's basically a question of whether we continue to pursue this competitive approach to the world, competing for the last of the world's resources, which leads to an ultimate collapse of the entire system and even threatening the survival of our species. Or we can choose to take a cooperative stance to share what remains of Earth's resources, rebuild our environmental systems, and create a world that works for all. Now, we're confronted politically by a group of neoliberals, the neoliberal economic ideology, and, you know, driven by corporate CEOs, hedge fund managers, and so forth, using the instruments of the World Trade Organization, World Bank, and IMF, to create a global governance system that essentially circumvents democracy and removes constraints on corporate power to the ultimate consolidation of corporate power and the power of global financial mechanisms. And through the trade agreements, through the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and IMF, we've been spreading our own ultimately very destructive economic system out to the rest of the world. Now, this is all based on an underlying story that making money is creating wealth. And since corporations and financial speculators are the ones that are making the big money, we've created a political concept or ideology that says, you know, the more we can favor these people, the wealthier we are all going to be, spreading the benefits to everyone. And this, of course, is nonsense. It in fact creates a set of rules that, as I noted, are increasing inequality and creating many of these stresses that then we respond to with military force. Now, we also see an enormous influence on our foreign policy by a group known as the neocons, the neoconservatives, who are operating with an ideology that the world order depends on a superpower imposing order by military force, and that either we rule the world or someone else is going to rule us, so we must commit our national treasure and reputation to the task of imposing order on the world to secure our interests. And we're, of course, seeing the consequences of that playing out in all sorts of devastation. Both the neoliberal and the neocon interventions are based on flawed stories, and I think we'll talk more about this later. Part of our challenge is to change the underlying stories that frame our political discourse.
Thank you, David. And Dot Maver.
Yes, thank you, Michael. And putting this together with what Sarah and David have so eloquently and articulately shared, as you know, I look consistently at what is working and what is emerging. Paul Hawken has just put out a book fairly recently called Blessed Unrest, and he says the greatest social change movement in the history of humanity is underway, and there's actually not a specific leader, nor is there a name. And yet, as both Sarah and David are pointing out, we actually face perhaps the greatest health and safety crisis of epidemic proportion that perhaps we've ever faced, and its name is violence in all its various forms. And crisis, as David alluded to, both danger and opportunity, I too think there's a great opportunity that we face, and it is really about conscious choice at this moment in time, and it's a redefining moment, and we are the very definition. So as we move proactively towards a world that actually works for everyone, I think one of the best examples right now is medicine, actually, which is now based on health and wellness and asking the questions what it takes to be healthy and well, where we used to be focused on sickness, on illness, and then we attacked what was sick or wrong, which is, I think, a good metaphor, so, and which is also now tied to a fitness movement that is all over the world. So if we look at politics for a moment, globally, we are actually seeing it more clearly in other countries than we are in the United States right now, that there is a reemergence of the democratic process everywhere that recognizes that politics are not separate from we the people. And grassroots organizations across the board want to see something happening that actually reflects their values, ordinary people getting involved in all kinds of ways, and we are just beginning to realize that we can learn to deal with conflict wisely and responsibly before it escalates to violence. And there's all kinds of violence, economic violence and social violence and physical violence, all kinds of violence. So as we look at the shift from living in what I'll call a triangle of a culture of violence, of direct structural and cultural violence, what will it take to shift into this culture of peace, direct structural and cultural peace? And I do think, as Sarah suggested, at the time of the superpowers, of the even of the great leaders per se, we are seeing the end of that, and I think that's a natural process. And if we can do this gracefully and do this consciously and make choice, it can be a defining moment for us as a human species, as we choose cooperation, as David has said, rather than this tremendous competitive spirit that we see, this hyper-individualism, particularly here in the U.S. So it's a very hopeful time, I think, and I look forward to the conversation talking about specifics. And right now in this country alone, we spend over $500 billion a year just dealing with the effects of violence. So imagine for us to deal with a prevention and ultimate doing away with violence.
Thank you so much, Dot. It reminds me of a quote, I think probably 15 years ago, Thich Nhat Hanh had a quote. He said, the next Buddha is not going to be a person, it's going to be a community. Yeah. And as I hear you speaking and all three of you, the call for a true United Nations coming together seems more important now than ever in all history. So I'd like to think about, how did we get in this mess right now? How did we get here? Let's start with you, David Corton.
Well, I see it going back, having very deep historical roots. If we look at the record, the dominant societies of the human species took a turn about 5,000 years ago from societies that on the whole were more egalitarian, peaceful, and gender balanced, to societies that were organized on dominator structures with a few on the top and most people on the bottom. The story of how that happened is a little too complicated to go into here, but what it ended up creating was a situation in which you have an inexorable competition for the positions at the top, And it's very difficult to break out of, because if you don't invade and dominate your neighbor, you are very likely to be invaded by and dominated by your neighbor. If you're not competing for the positions at the top, you will be forever cast into the position at the bottom. Now, we're still living with that basic dynamic. It is a deeply self-destructive pattern, and out of it, we have created stories that have essentially said, this is the only way that we can live, that it is our human nature to be competitive, to be violent, to be greedy, materialistic. So this is just the way we are, and we need to learn to live with it, using market forces to channel the competition in constructive ways, but even more counting on dominant leaders and dominant institutions to impose order. Now, all of that clouds our ability to see what we know from our daily experience, that in fact, most of our relationships with the people that we deal with are based on relationships of trust and mutual caring, cooperation and sharing. And that if we look more deeply, we realize that most all of the people in the world actually want much the same thing. You know, I've spent most of my adult life and career working in countries all around the world, in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And one of the extraordinary things out of that experience is realizing that for all our cultural differences, we actually mostly all want the same thing. We want a world of healthy, happy children, families, communities, and natural systems. And yet our cultural stories that shape our politics and our political discussion basically deny all that and leave us without a space for even imagining a world living in peaceful cooperation, sharing the resources of the planet. You know, this has led me to a sense that reexamining, changing our underlying cultural stories is one of the most important works of our time.
Would you like to also address that, please, Sarah?
Just picking up on what Dave just said, you know, I think the upcoming issue of Yes is on happiness, so I've been thinking a lot about what mm-hmm. creates happiness. And you know, there's all sorts of interesting research that's being done on this. One is that over the last, you know, the years since World War II, our GDP, our gross domestic product, our economy has been growing, but our well-being has actually leveled off and our levels of depression are going up. So what's going on, you know, if we're getting more and more stuff all the time, and this stuff is supposed to give us happiness. I mean, if you watch the movies and you watch television, you see that all the rich people have, you know, got all this stuff and they must be having a good time and everybody wants more of it. And you watch advertising and everybody wants more stuff for themselves. And, you know, there's this sort of cultural assumption that's been very carefully built up by the advertising industry that in order to be happy, we have to have more and more stuff. And when people actually sit and reflect on that a little bit, they realize that is not, in fact, what makes them happy. And certainly the research backs that up. The research that's recently coming out in the field of positive psychology shows some of the things that do make people happy, and they have to do with rich relationships with other people. They have to do with having work that's meaningful and feeling like you're making a contribution and feeling like people respect and care about the work that you're doing in the world. So there are real things that lead to happiness, and almost none of them have to do with consumerism. And yet our whole economy is built on American consumers buying more and more stuff, and then our whole relationships to the rest of the world are also founded in this notion that George Bush Sr. stated so eloquently at the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, where he said, the American way of life is not up for negotiation. We Americans insist that we must be able to consume at the level we're consuming now and more all the time. And the fact that that means that the rest of the world's resources have to be accessible to us, we will enforce that right by military means if necessary. And that's the implications of saying that the American way of life
exactly.
is not up for negotiation. Mm-hmm. So that sets us up for a situation where we, you know, we're consuming a quarter of the world's energy resources, but we're only 5% of the population. Well, how can you have that kind of a situation without violence, without a huge military to back that up? That's the situation we've gotten ourselves into, and it's hard to say who's to blame. I mean, you could say the advertising industry is to some degree, but to some degree, we Americans who are buying into that system are also then insisting that our political leaders do what it takes to keep us filling up our gas tanks with cheap gas. And we, the American people, have got to insist on a different direction now, or we're really in trouble. I mean, we're really in trouble because of climate change, as well as being in trouble in terms of not being able to continue this military aggression that it takes to acquire the level of resources that is supporting this standard of living. And, the, you know, the good news is that if we actually want to be happier, we don't need all that stuff. We can actually be quite a bit happier if we have a few other things, like a little bit greater level of equality so that we don't feel like somebody else is getting all the stuff and we're being left behind. And we don't have to have this sense of insecurity that somebody is going to, you know, push us out of our houses because, you know, we can't afford the mortgage anymore. I mean, there's a lot of societies where, you know, people who work for a living can feel pretty secure that they can actually afford a place to live and be able to feed their family. So we certainly need that to be happy. But then there's a lot of other things that are more intangible, like a sense of community and a sense of having a beautiful environment and feeling like we're leaving the world a better place for our children. And those are things that do not require using up the world's resources and do allow us to be in relationships with other parts of the world, other communities in the world that could be a very productive, very peaceful, and very exciting relationship based on equality and based on appreciating the rich diversity of cultures that there are in the world.
One of the unexamined assumptions that I hear often is that, well, war is inevitable and it's the way it's always been and it always will be that way. You know, we can't take the first step because we'll have terrorists on our soil taking over and we won't be able to buy our stuff. Dot, would you address that along with any other comments, but that particular assumption that I've heard often?
That is really what it is, an assumption. That word assume gets you every time, right? You know,
yes.
The breakdown of that word. So at any rate, I really think that it is about the story. And in terms of even the focus on terrorism and fear, and frankly, I'm not sure how you fight terror. And so when we talk about the story, we have managed over these, and particularly the last few hundred years, and in this country, obviously, the last couple hundred years, we have managed to write chapter after chapter built on certain assumptions that, as the Chinese proverb says, if you keep going in the direction you're going, you will likely get there, and that are not taking us in a good direction, nor the direction most of us want to go to. And one of the turning points there is when we first started all this business, and business originally, and Adam Smith, you know, in terms of business and why we started with money and exchange in those ways to make things easier for ourselves. And there was a large faction of the business community early on thinking it was a good idea to have business support the community. And it gradually shifted, the story did, to value ourselves, who we are, how we are, by money. We drive down a street. If there's a big house, they must have a lot of money. If there's someone sitting on the street corner, oh, I bet they don't have a lot of money. Everything is valued virtually by money these days. And money, for me, is no more or less than concretized spiritual energy. And when we think about it like that, then we need to question those chapters building on that false assumption that create a story based on fear, deprivation, there's not enough for everybody, there's hardly anybody in that top echelon, as David and Sarah have both pointed out. So what would it be if we, as we the people, began to write this new story that David's calling forth and that Sarah speaks about, where we offer our unique contributions on behalf of the common good, and we are valued on sharing, and we value ourselves based on those unique contributions, and where all needs are met in this picture, and money takes its place as part of a system of commerce, perhaps, or maybe not down the road, we'll see, but that we value the essence and unique contributions rather than that. And then we get away from the fear-based, what about terrorism, we start to look at why. We start to look at the root causes of violence and address those root causes, and everybody gets to tell their story. And we realize, Michael, that we're not so different from anybody else, and our acting out, there's always a reason for the acting out. When it's with little children, it's much easier to see and ultimately to deal with than as we get older and it becomes so abhorrently violent and we just want to lash back. But we know that that is not the answer. So that's how I would address that, is by we need more and more to deal with the root causes and to be dealing, all of us, beginning with our very young children, in creating this story that is the emerging story of a culture that actually is a culture of and practice of peace, where our world works for everyone. And those practical, pragmatic pieces need to be so defined economically, in education, with the environment, with the interfaith community. That's how I would address that.
I'm reminded of when I was in the consulting business, I had an opportunity to work with the Israeli Ministry of Education. And the question that we were working was, what's the root cause of violence in our schools? And so they sat down at tables and they were discussing this, and people would then report back. And if you've ever been to Israel, you know that there's kids everywhere carrying guns. And this one person got up and said, we think the root cause is because our society condones violence. Thereupon, people jumped up out of their chairs and started a screaming match in the middle of the Ministry of Education. I had to sit back and just really observe and then have them really look at what was going on. And I think that's such an important thing, as we take an opportunity to stand back like we're doing here and look at these unexamined beliefs and assumptions, even though we know that consumption, for instance, isn't the thing that's ultimately bringing us happiness. And then I look at the power of media. And Sarah, maybe you could start this one off. You know, we're community radio and we have NPR radio and we get out to some number of people. But the overwhelming impact of media, where people watch an average of 4 hours of television a day, how do we begin to make inroad to that? You write so eloquently in your magazine and you speak that way, and yet how do we meet the masses with this new kind of consciousness?
Well, yeah, I think you've identified one of the really big questions, and it's something that I find really troubling, given especially the erosion of democracy within our three branches of government, to also have the fourth arena where democracy is so essential, which is the media, where you have the watchdog function and you have the independence of people outside government keeping an eye on things. You know, to have that whole sector be compromised is really quite terrifying. And that's what's been happening, as you know. There's been a consolidation so that fewer and fewer corporations are owning more and more of the media outlets. And so, you know, you get a combination of self-censorship because you're not going to run stories that your corporate parent isn't going to like. You get the news departments cut down to almost nothing. You have to generate huge profits to keep the corporate owners happy. So that means you have to pander to the lowest common denominator in order to get the numbers, to get the advertisers to keep the profits rolling in. You know, it's not enough to just cover your costs. You have to have those, you know, be lining the pockets of your shareholders with the extra profits. So, yes, on every level, this is just a disaster for democracy to have this happening. The good news, of course, is the Internet. You know, ordinary citizens, ordinary people are able to say what they want to say. They're, in some cases, able to break out and actually reach very large audiences. The newspapers are not able to be the gatekeepers. The newspapers in the corporate-owned television stations and radio are not able to keep the voices of ordinary people from being heard, because there are so many ways now of bypassing those channels. I mean, anybody who wants to can have their own television station now and broadcast on YouTube. This isn't to say it's not a problem, because those tend to have smaller audiences, and we don't tend to be able to have the conversations between different sectors of the population, because each of those programs tends to have a very narrow audience. But nonetheless, that is a place where there's, I think, a lot of hope and linking and cross-linking that happens among bloggers and among websites is one way that we're sort of creating, if you will, a knowledge base, an understanding of what's happening that is sort of making an end run around that corporate blockade.
Good point, Sarah. I'm wondering, when you have our consumption model being taken by particularly China and India, and then you have the Internet taken over, again, I'm looking at, well, what can we do here to get the word out? David, would you address that a little bit?
Well, of course, far as using those same internet tools to carry out the education about the need for alternative outlets. And, of course, we have to very strongly focus on protecting the freedom of access to the internet and its uses. I mean, I think part of what we miss in the focus on the corporate media is the rise of independent media, of bloggers and so forth, both in print form but increasingly in electronic form. And as you say, the efforts to control the internet are indeed scary in that regard. But I think, you know, a part of what I've come to realize is that, you know, we've gotten into this mess in part because of the ability of right-wing ideologues, you know, backed by corporate interests to shape the cultural stories by which we understand what it means to be human and understand what our possibilities are. Now, one can say that, you know, given they control the corporate media, puts them at a substantial advantage. And yet the advantage on our side lies, I think, with our natural human tendencies toward health, happiness, and cooperation, and the evidence that the healthy course of development of the human consciousness, the human psyche, is toward ever-increasing cooperation and ever-larger sense of identity with nature, with other people, with the larger community. I find particular hope and interest in some of the new research coming out of our study of the human brain that's made possible by various kinds of new imaging technologies that are beginning to demonstrate quite conclusively that, in fact, the human brain is wired to reward caring, cooperation, and service. You know, this research is finding, for example, that merely thinking about another person experiencing some form of harm triggers the same reaction in our brain as when a mother sees distress in her baby's face. On the other side of it, when we engage in an act of helping or cooperation, that triggers the brain's pleasure center and in turn benefits our health by boosting our immune system, reducing our heart rate, and preparing us to approach and to soothe. Positive emotions like compassion have similar benefits. Now, what this means is there is this innate tendency that the new stories of our human possibilities speak to. And, you know, there's the old thing about propaganda that to tell a lie, you have to repeat it over and over and over again. But the truth has the advantage in breaking through because most people are able to recognize rather quickly the difference between the true story and the false story once they hear the true story. And that's what is a major source of my sense of hope and possibility.
That's really well said. Dot, you've had a lot of experience. I'm going to just step back a little bit to the media here. You've had a lot of experience as the campaign manager for Denis Kucinich and with your peace work through the years. And one of the things I love is that you really look at what we want rather than what we don't want. But that's not what the media is after. Can you talk a little bit about how you've dealt with the media and your thoughts about it?
Yeah, thanks for that, Michael. Because I, like David, I have great, and Sarah, I have great hope right now for the direction we're actually moving, although we don't see it yet. And at the media, candidly, I found very challenging because no one wanted to talk about peace. And in fact, peace was simply defined as anti-war. And for me, peace is not about being anti-war. It's not even about just the end of violence. It's about the presence of truth, the presence of justice, the presence of a culture where our needs get met across the board. And so for me, peace journalism is a field that's emerging, but we're not so aware of it yet. Jake Lynch in Australia, Marianne Perez in New York here in this country, and I could name other names that, as I'm sure all three of us could, around the world. And I am seeing it particularly with the youth and saw it that way through the Kucinich campaign. We had a very large intern program, and most of those youth were very media savvy, and they kept affirming for me that while the television, yes, is still a great number in this country, our youth are actually not at the age of those interns watching as much television as we think they are. They are much more inclined to be texting and doing the video kind of thing and computer, internet, as Sarah points out, that great saving grace, actually, at proving our interconnectedness in very remarkable ways. And our youth, through the World Youth Spirit Forum, through Peace Jam, working with the Nobel laureates, through Youth for Environmental Sanity and Seeds of Peace, and hundreds and thousands of groups around the planet, are becoming their own media. They are putting forth the need and how to Ryan's Well, all those wells in those communities in Africa, bringing fresh water as he continues. He started when he was 6. He's now, 17 in Canada. We could tell story after story. And they get it, as David said, about health, happiness, and cooperation, and are extending that hand. And as Aaron Voldman, the executive director of the Student Peace Alliance, has said often, we need to make friends with one another and develop healthy relationships with our brothers and sisters around the world, because we will pick up the phone or we will get in touch via internet or whatever. We will not go to war with one another.
Very well said. Two of the things that I feel are challenges that I would love for you all to address, and that's the issue of denial and the issue of entitlement that I find in our, particularly in our U.S. culture. There's widespread denial, as you were saying earlier. If people stop and think, they will see that this is not the right direction. It doesn't bring happiness. It isn't fulfilling, and we're going in the wrong direction. 81% of Americans say that. And yet there's this huge level of denial of dealing with it. You know, we still drive our SUVs. We still live a very consumptive lifestyle. And on top of that, there seems to be behind that a sense of entitlement. Perhaps that's only my impression, but I'd like to hear, Sarah, would you like to talk about that?
Sure. I think on the denial, I think it's tied up with a sense of powerlessness. I think, you know, if you sit down and tell somebody some bad news, and they don't feel that there's anything they can do about it, I think they often tend to just not let it in. Because to let it in is just to make yourself feel bad if you don't feel like you actually have the power to do anything. So somehow we have allowed ourselves as citizens of this country to start feeling like we are out of control. Like, you know, somebody else is going to make all the decisions. They're probably going to be in Washington, D.C. and in corporate headquarters. And in fact, that reflects reality pretty well. But we can't continue to allow that to happen that way. We have to take back some power. And I think when we start feeling that power, we'll also be able to sort of nudge ourselves out of that sense of denial. What we found at Yes Magazine in terms of reporting on this is that a lot of the places people feel most powerful is closer to home. They feel like, okay, you know, for example, we did an issue on climate change, and we did a two-page spread that shows one mythical family, the Joneses, we call them, who over 10 years went from having a regular American carbon footprint to having zero carbon emissions. And we showed how what they did every year that was not radical, it was not something that most Americans couldn't do, but every year they took some steps, and in 10 years they reached zero carbon emissions. So, you know, a lot of people, I think, feel when they see that article, they think, wow, you know, this is something I can do. And that kind of opens their heart and opens their sense of possibility to moving out of the phase of denial, like, oh, my God, climate change is just something that's so big, I don't even have a way to have any effect on it. And I think that tends to also give them that sense of commitment, because if I can do something, then at least some people will say, you know what, I will do it. So sometimes it's really close to home. Sometimes it's in the community, and sometimes it's in the city level. The Cities for Peace, for example, has been working with cities all over the country on getting resolutions that call for us to leave Iraq, that call for us not to go into war with Iran. You know, at the city level, the government tends to be much more responsive to what the American people actually want than at the national level, unfortunately. So where people feel that sense of power, I think they are making a difference, and they are moving out of denial. The entitlement question is a really tricky one, because I think that to some degree has to do with our sense of, you know, American exceptionalism, which I think tends to go along with being, you know, our perception that, well, we're an empire, well, we're somehow morally superior in some way to other people, well, we're somehow entitled to all those resources of the world. And I think it's a kind of a fragile sense of entitlement. I think a lot of people are gradually coming to see that, well, maybe we really aren't entitled to the resources of other people in other parts of the world. But what does that mean? How do I actually reorient my life so that I can start using my fair share, and we as a country can start living within our own means? And I think when we get to where we can grapple with that question in very practical ways, I think there will be much more willingness to move in that direction.
I do want to say that was a great article, and tell people that they can go to yesmagazine.org. How do they find that particular article?
Yesmagazine.org. You can Google the Joneses, or you can Google our climate change issue. The whole website is searchable with pretty much all the articles we've done in the last 10 years.
Very good. Thanks. David or Dot, either one, what's your thought about this denial and entitlement that seems to be part of the fabric of our society?
I'm happy to piggyback on what Sarah just said, because I do think it has to do with that powerlessness she was talking about, and also a struggle to meet day-to-day needs for so many citizens of the United States right now. But I also want to relate it to something you said earlier, Michael, which is the post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes.
I don't know if you know the work of Ed Tick.
I had him on the show, actually.
What beautiful, War on the Soul, yeah, and the work that he's doing and helping us recognize that part of the reason that we sometimes tend to be in denial about things also is that the symptom that really shows up so poignantly right now and requires more attention than we are giving it even, that healing actually needs to happen for all of us. We all are demonstrating PTSD or PTSS symptoms. And I look at South Africa with the truth and reconciliation work that has began a profound healing process. And more, I think that's how we regain our relationships with our, beginning with ourselves and then moving it forward. And in terms of entitlement, for me, as particularly as I continue to work with so many youth over these many years, I think we take a lot for granted. I mean, I know that's a blinding glimpse, but the truth is we don't know a whole lot outside our borders, and that's it can be seen as arrogant, it can be seen as entitlement issues. More and more, as we learn that we are not the only ones in the world, and that what other countries are dealing with, and particularly with so many youth that we work with, it changes not only the perception, but the actions and relationships dramatically. And, you know, Bill McKibben has written a book called Deep Economy, and I love one of the stories in that book where he talks about two birds living in a tree, and they're called More and Better. And up to a certain point in time, for all of us, having more is actually better. And no matter where you go around this planet, there's a certain amount of, even giving it, if we gave it a dollar value, of money or at least some kind of resource necessary to meet our daily needs. But at a certain point, once that's achieved for all of us and basic needs and a little beyond are met, he says more and better used to live in the same tree, and particularly in the United States. And now, a couple decades ago, better flew off and made a nest in a different tree. So the big question we face is more still better? And where is the principle of sharing in all of that?
Very nice. I want to underline one thing that you said about the work of Ed Tick, because I think personally, particularly having Ed on the show here, that this is one of the social time bombs that we have. When I read earlier the number of people with PTSD, huge, you know, somewhere between 300,000 and 600,000 people in our country, in our communities. And as a vet myself, and knowing many people from the Vietnam era, it's not something that's easy to talk about. And I want to invite our listeners to adopt a vet wherever you see one. Whenever I'm on a plane and I see a young person in uniform or wherever I go, I try to connect and make contact. Not to tell them they're doing anything wrong or anything, but just to listen to them because they so need to be listened to. It's just such an important thing. I want to underline that. And David Corton, one of the things I didn't talk about earlier about you is that you served in the Vietnam War as a captain in the Air Force, and you worked with the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Advanced Research Projects Agency at Air Force Headquarters, and as an instructor at the Special Air Warfare School. You're also a member of the Veterans for Peace. I would like you to talk about maybe some of the issues around the denial areas, but I'd like to talk a little bit about your experience there as it applies to where we are in the conversation and where we are right now.
Yeah, well, this moves us in a slightly
little to the side
back to to our national policy and empire. Going back to the general Vietnam experience, this had a lot of impact on basic military doctrine and understanding of the nature of different kinds of warfare. And of course, in Vietnam, we were up against a very unconventional enemy. I became, you know, very focused during that time teaching at the Special Air Warfare School, where I was teaching civic action and psychological operations. And in the Pentagon, I was working in the areas of the social science research. So we were trying to understand the nature of that conflict and the nature of what it meant to win the war. And you may recall that back in that time there was lots of discussion of, you know, winning hearts and minds. And, you know, there was a deep truth in that, even though it's a bit of a cliche, that in that kind of warfare where you're not really facing, you know, conventional armies lining up against one another, but you are dealing with insurgents, people that within the current lexicon would be referred to as terrorists. Others might call them patriots, but you know they're not wearing conventional uniforms. They blend in with the population. They are generally supported by the population. You know, the only way you can win that kind of war in a conventional sense is through total extermination of the population, which is hardly a victory. But, you know, really resolving the conflict depends on winning over convincing people that to end the conflict and that there is an alternative that that will lead them on a path to a better life. Now, kind of the deeper lesson of this is that you simply cannot win an unconventional or what some refer to as an asymmetric war with conventional military force, with armies and air forces and navies and so forth that are basically designed to fight other conventional military forces. When the supposed enemy is melding in with the population, the more you use conventional military force, the more you activate resistance. Actually, one of the courses that I taught in the Special Air Warfare School was on the psychological impact of bombing. So I studied all the literature available on the psychological impact of bombing on civilian populations. And it leads to a very surprising conclusion that if you bomb people, it makes them very angry and mobilizes their commitment to resist, which, of course, is exactly the opposite of the result that you want in that kind of situation. And I was so struck when, you know, our government announced we were going to start the war in Iraq with shock and awe bombing. You know, obviously, the folks that were planning that were not familiar with that literature.
They didn't attend your classes.
They didn't attend my classes. You look at all that in a larger context, and what you recognize is that, you know, first of all, as a nation, the United States, we face no unconventional enemies. There are simply there is no threat to us from some army invading our borders, you know, unless we're able to create a conflict, as we seem to be intent on doing in Georgia with another power like Russia. But in the basic course of things, we don't face that kind of enemy. The wars that we've gotten into in the last many years are are unconventional warfares, the kind of thing that we're facing in Iraq. We're not lined up against any conventional army. It's totally an insurgent enemy. It's basically the same thing in Afghanistan. And our conventional military force it can only worsen those situations. It cannot resolve them, which means that if we were to follow a realistic security path, we would focus our attention on dismantling our military, reallocating our resources to other helpful, more beneficial uses, including helping create a world in which other people can better use control and use their own resources to create better lives for themselves. Now, this would lead to the kind of foreign policy that Sarah's talking about, based on fundamentally different principles of cooperation and sharing to create a world that works for all rather than focused on trying to impose our particular will and interests on the rest of the world by a conventional military force. And it is, it's the difference between a smart security policy and a very stupid, self-destructive security policy.
Very good. Before we move into really building on the future that you've been talking about and alluding to, and I want to get into more depth about that, any more comments about how we ended up in this situation, or are we pretty well complete on that?
Well, actually, I'd like to pick up on the sense of helplessness, entitlement, and I think that's a very complex set of issues. You know, the people that are running around in their SUVs, partly it's getting caught up in an identity thing, but it's also, in many cases, it's a defensive measure. If everybody else is buying SUVs, then you feel very intimidated in your small car, and you can't see the road ahead of you and so forth. And so, I'm going to get an SUV too. But I'm also very struck by some of the psychological research on, what inequality does to our sense of identity and sense of sufficiency. What this research suggests is that in situations where there's a high degree of equity, we tend to get more of our satisfaction from relationships. We're less dependent on material possessions for defining ourselves for satisfaction. But as you move toward ever-increasing inequality, and particularly when backed by the kinds of advertising that we live that shape our culture, the whole culture orients it towards evaluating ourselves and assessing our own worth by our possessions relative to the possessions of others. You know, there's quite an extraordinary book out by the wealth reporter of the Wall Street Journal, whose job is to follow around the richest people in the world and comment on their lifestyles. The book's called Richistan. But he talks about how, at the very upper levels of the super wealthy, how the guy that's only got a 400-foot yacht gets to feel very competitive about the guy who's just built a 425-foot yacht. And so he needs a 450-foot yacht. You know, this gets into an area of deep psychological dysfunction when we evaluate ourselves. The culture actually keeps sending us the signals that it's the guy with the biggest yacht, the biggest private jet, and so forth, who is really the most worthy and the most to be valued in the culture. And that if you're not playing the game, you're the chump, you're a loser, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, the whole advertising industry is intended to communicate those messages to tell us that we deserve more, and that's the measure of our identity. Now, partly what I think is happening is we are seeing an awakening of a new cultural consciousness, I think this is I sense a great division among our youth. Some of them are even more totally caught up in the culture framed by the advertising, but I think more and more of them are also breaking free from that, from recognizing that that this advertising is a form of cultural manipulation, and they're saying, I'm not going to have anything to do with that. Now, I've also become very struck from my own experience you know, growing up in a very culturally homogeneous small town as a child, but then spending my life interacting with the great diversity of the world's cultures. Now, one of the things that broad international experience does is create an awareness of culture as a variable. You know, when we just grow up in our culture, we tend to just see that as reality. That's just the way things are. But as we are immersed in many different cultures, we begin to realize, wow, culture, that's not just the way things are, but there are many different ways of seeing the world. Culture is a variable, and it's the lens through which we see the world, but there are very many possibilities, and it's within our means, and indeed it is our responsibility to choose our lens by which we see the world and to be much more conscious in our value choices. And that process, I think, is developing among a growing number of people of immunity to advertising. You know, as more and more people break out of what I call the cultural trance and develop that immunity, we, you know, as we find each other and reinforce each other's sense of the freedom, the liberation that comes from that, we realize that we're not so crazy, we're not so out of step, that it's the dominant culture that is that's pathological. And so the more people break out of it, the faster the awakening spreads, and that again is a major source of hope.
David, I just want to add one thing to that. You started to talk about the idea of cooperation, but the three parts of the evolving brain in the article, I can't remember the name of it, that you wrote for Yes Magazine.
Yeah, we're hardwired to connect.
That we're hardwired to connect.
That's in the fall issue, yeah.
Yeah, in the larger brain. That it's actually an evolutionary process that we're engaged in, which could also give us some hope in that sense, that we're naturally evolving towards that, is it the limbic brain that...
Let me just run through quickly the three-part brain. The base of our brain is what referred to as the reptilian brain. That's our basic physical functions, but it's also the site of our fear response, the fight or flight, sense of territoriality, the kind of physical defensive posture. And, of course, you know, reptiles are known for their, rather emotional and violent nature. Then on top of that is the limbic or mammalian brain, which is the source of our social intelligence. It's the thing that gives mammals their capacity to actively care for their young and to form bonds of cooperation and caring and mutual help. And then in humans, on top of that, is the neocortical brain, which is the center of our cognitive intelligence, our capacity for self-awareness, for reason and logic. That's the part that makes us distinctively human among mammals. Now, both the limbic or mammalian and the neocortical brains develop largely after birth and are very much influenced by our social interactions. And a thing that is very disturbing is that the mammalian brain, which is the source of our social intelligence and our capacities for cooperation and compassion, depend very much on loving, nurturing, caring relationships early on and throughout our life. And, you know, you begin to look at that in the context of an economy that virtually demands that as a price of survival, that both parents work, and therefore leaving children without proper care or in the care of sort of institutional caregivers, we're moving in a direction that does not nurture the development of that very essential function. We also, in our education system, give very little attention to that, and even in our cognitive development, tend to break our education down into disciplines that fragment our problem solving and our capacity to think about the world, which is very inhibiting and does not develop our capacity to see the larger picture and the systemic nature of our crises. So, in a way, what you could say is that, you know, we're still developing certain more narrow analytic capacities, which are the capacities that allow us to develop ever more violent weapons, etc., technology abstracted from any sense of values as to how it's applied. So you might say that we're engaged in an evolutionary experiment to create a new breed of highly intelligent reptiles, which is very dangerous.
Now, and also holds great possibility and promise, too.
It does, because not everyone has succumbed to these forces. But it also, as you suggest, it means that we can consciously, intentionally create societies that are geared to developing and actualizing the highest potentials of our human nature and the potentials of the human brain.
One of the things that's always been interesting to me is embodiment, having spent 25 years in corporations where people mainly are heads on sticks going to meetings and not very aware of their body. And I often look at our relationship to the earth as a function of our not being in the body. And this whole physical evolution and the possibility that we're talking about here and that we're moving more deeply into now seems to me to be, if we would take the time to listen to our own nature, our own physiological, our own emotional, our own cognitive evolution, we would see that we're all programmed to thrive. Everything in nature is programmed to thrive and to cooperate and to grow together, which, of course, brings us to the next area, looking at the new possible futures that arrive out of these new stories. And Sarah, you did a wonderful article on the future of nukes in the summer issue of Yes Magazine. I would like you to start out the possibility with that, because that's one of those dark fears that are in the closet that we all know are there.
That's right. I remember, as I think a lot of people do, the time during the Cold War when we felt that at any time the Russians could initiate a war, or we could, and we could, you know, lose our lives and our entire civilization, if not this human species, in very little time. And
no.
Unfortunately, those weapons are still out there and they're still aimed back and forth. So despite the end of the Cold War, we still have a tremendous nuclear problem, and we, of course, have the issue of proliferation, which is these weapons are increasingly moving around the world and being adopted by other countries and also potentially by stateless warriors or terrorists or however you want to call them. So we have a huge question here of what we're going to do about that, and the hopeful news that we had in the current issue, in the foreign policy issue of Yes Magazine, was that some of the people who were actually involved in the Cold War, including George Shultz, Sam Nunn, Henry Kissinger, have come out in favor of complete abolition of nuclear weapons. This article that you mentioned, one of the two pieces was an interview I did with former Secretary of State George Shultz, who was Secretary of State in the Reagan administration. And, you know, he's now retired from government, and he's looking around at the dangers of these weapons and of the proliferation of these weapons, and he's saying, you know, really the only solution is abolition. Mm. We just have to get rid of them. The Non-Proliferation Treaty that we hear about in the news a lot of times, you know, we hear about it when a new country is looking at acquiring nuclear weapons like Iran. And, you know, the treaty, for those who have signed the treaty, they basically promise not to acquire nuclear weapons, although they're entitled to using nuclear energy. The part of the treaty that we don't hear about very often in the news is that the nuclear powers, like the United States and Russia and China, also made a commitment in that same treaty to gradually rid themselves of nuclear weapons. So we, are, in fact, the United States has the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons, and we're now out of compliance with this treaty because we failed to take the steps we need to take to draw down and eventually eliminate those nuclear weapons. So George Shultz is essentially saying, and these others are essentially saying, you know, there really can't be a viable system of nuclear haves and have-nots. We really have to all get rid of them or we're all in danger. And the United States has to take the lead on that because we do own the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons. And in recent years especially, we've been most resistant to, you know, the arms control treaties that could move us toward in the direction we need to be getting. So it's very encouraging seeing that coming from the, you know, certainly the peace movement, the anti-nuclear movement has been working on this for many years, and I think helping to create a consensus among a lot of Americans. I think our current issue shows that 73% of Americans favor this abolition of nuclear weapons, if there's a way of verifying that they've been abolished. So the American people are there, and certainly the people of the other countries of the world are there. The question, I think, is if the U.S. government can step up and do what so clearly needs to be done.
And I think it's very hopeful, though, that the people who we once considered hawks, and perhaps some of them still are.
A new pragmatism coming in and, you know, marking a time for bold rethinking and bold initiatives. And there's, you know, there's one here that connects right in with the current news. We don't really hear anyone talking about in terms of a larger possibility, but you know the whole situation with Georgia and Russia, you know, which is potentially an extraordinary inflammatory situation in which the neocons and the Bush administration are acting in a way to embarrass and isolate Russia in ways that are. Well, which are really calculated to stimulate more violent and aggressive response in the direction of renewing the Cold War. I heard one commentary that I found really striking, that after the fall of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, which was Russia's equivalent of NATO, of course, dissolved. We actually had a choice at that point in time that we could have acted to dissolve NATO, which was created specifically to counter the perceived threat from Russia and the Soviet bloc. But instead, we have chosen to attempt to expand NATO to include the nations of the former Soviet bloc, which further isolates Russia and is taken by Russia as a hostile, aggressive move, which some people think is very much behind their intervention in Georgia. We still basically have the choice that we could fundamentally shift our position and enter into negotiations based on the idea of rolling back NATO rather than trying to bring Georgia, Ukraine, and other former Warsaw Pact nations into NATO. This, to me, is a current and very compelling example of the nature of the very large choices where we could be doing things very differently and creating the possibility for far more positive outcomes.
Yeah, this is Dot. I'd just like to comment on that. I agree with what David is suggesting there based on how things are. And as you all know, a large part of the work that we are doing through Peace Partnership International is to work with the Global Alliance for Ministries and Departments of Peace and to call for ministers and secretaries and departments in countries throughout the world where there would be a focus on peace building and those very strategies that would help us dialogue. There being a difference in my way of thinking between even dialogue and diplomacy, and that some of these things would then be looked at through the lens of cooperation and what is the best in order for all to thrive, knowing that true human security, and as Tom Barnett, who used to be with the Pentagon, has said in his book, The Pentagon's New Map, what we know now is that our security is actually based on strong civil society infrastructure. And so it goes against the grain of common sense politics and strategy to be destroying infrastructure. And at this time, I'm pleased to share with you that Costa Rica, and of course we know about their government and disarmament and leading the way in that regard, they have just invited the Global Alliance. The government will host our fourth summit in Costa Rica next September, where President Oscar Arias and Vice President Laura Chinchilla will be actively involved, and as will Ambassador Chaudhry from the United Nations. So we are seeking to help create some of those very structures that would then look at those possibilities that both David and Sarah are outlining.
That's very exciting. You've also just been named NGO to the United Nations, too, which is quite a big step for you, isn't it?
Well, it is for our group, and we are seeking to work with the various missions, particularly with the 35 countries represented through the Global Alliance, to put a call out globally, and actually both David and Sarah have been active with this also, to take a serious look at Article 9 from the Japanese Constitution and the possibility of countries framing or reframing peace constitutions along the lines of governments that basically say that we can live in a culture where war is not the common denominator, where it's a new common denominator, if you will. Call it what you will. So, yes, that's very hopeful, and we're also working with Ambassador Chaudhry to put a resolution into the General Assembly calling for the structures in governments throughout the world that support and encourage a culture of peace.
Dot, could you say a little more about Article 9? I don't think most people are familiar with that. A little bit about the history of it and also the possibility that you and many others are working with right now.
Yes, there's actually a global movement. There was just a conference in May in Japan. Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, it's actually the United States who pretty much insisted that this be put into the Constitution post the World War. It's in two parts. The first part is aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order. The Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. And secondly, in order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized. So there is now a push in Japan from within the government to rescind Article 9, and it's our understanding that that in large part has to do with the U.S. calling on the Japanese to help in the Mideast. At any rate, what we are saying in terms of a global movement is that let's take a look at a global Article 9 campaign that includes these steps that David has called for in terms of looking at disarmament and that Sarah's commenting on, that let's look at nuclear energy perhaps, but other than that, we simply will not, really as we the people, will not tolerate any further use of nuclear weaponry against one another.
And David, you've been very active in that also. Any more comments from you?
Well, I find the whole Article 9 initiative to be quite extraordinary, because it potentially opens up this conversation about a very different thrust in human affairs, and moving beyond the massive, what I would call, misallocation of the world's resources in support of war. And of course, this is not. It's not just about the money. I mean, money is just essentially printed by banks out of nothing. But you think about it in terms of the enormous waste of energy, of material resources, of human creativity, of human lives, the diversion of health resources away from, meeting natural health needs to dealing with the tremendous psychological and physical destruction of war. Just out of nowhere, talking about an approach to economic conversion and to renouncing war as an instrument of foreign policy. The Japanese experience gives a very, very practical framework, and of course, Japan has been extremely successful economically and in many other respects within that framework of Article 9. And I think part of what's interesting is, even though the Article 9 was basically imposed by the United States as an occupying force, it seems to be enormously popular among ordinary people in Japan, that they recognize that this makes them distinctive, but it also has contributed greatly to their ability to focus on their own development and well-being without this diversion of resources and without getting involved in international conflict. So I find it a very inspiring example, and think it's a wonderful precedent to build on.
Would be not a bad thing to have on a refrigerator magnet to remind ourselves, too.
Yeah, well, imagine if we had a similar provision in our U.S. Constitution, that we reject war as an instrument of foreign policy, and we will, we'll maintain a modest military force needed to address any actual physical threats to our borders, but we will not maintain a force that is even capable of projecting military power beyond our own borders, because You know, our goal is purely defensive. That would change our whole national economy in extraordinary ways, and our position in the world. Now, of course, you know, the idea is not to do this unilaterally, but it is to take this as a framework for discussions with all the countries of the world, and to begin to reverse the whole process. And of course, it would mean, you know, ending our extensive arms sales to the rest of the world.
Yeah,
now, of course, when you start talking about economic conversion, you know, such a major portion of our economy is devoted to military expenditures. You know, we'd have to have a very thoughtful and clear, in a sense, redeployment policy, which I think connects with the whole movement toward green jobs. You begin to think about all of the things in our society that really need to be done in terms of retrofitting our homes and solar energy and all these kinds of things. You know, we could begin to think of rolling back all of the economic activities that are devoted to military and warfare, and then reallocate those resources to healthcare, to education, to environmental restoration, and so forth. I just find it an amazing possibility.
Absolutely. Let's start to bring this home to the listener a little bit more. You know, the possibilities of creating a new paradigm in our own lives. And for me, that starts with our relationship in community. And Sarah, you've done a lot of work in communities. Can you address that from the community individual perspective?
Let me just add on one little piece to what Dave was saying.
Sure.
You know, if you think about the threats that are actually, you know, on the horizon, where there could be really major damage done to life and property and the environment and so forth, you know, you got to put things like climate change right at the top of the list. I mean, what the scientists are telling us, and this, we did an issue on climate change this spring, and I was so struck by how panicked a lot of the scientists were when they came to, you know, talking about the kinds of implications of what climate change could mean to our ability to feed ourselves, to coastal cities, to species extinction. I mean, this is a serious threat that, you know, talking about denial, that we are still in denial about, even among those of us who are changing our light bulbs and trying to drive energy efficient cars. So we need a mobilization that we haven't seen since World War II. You know, we need to reorient our society to take on this threat. And I think that's the kind of challenge that we need to be rising to by doing exactly what David was talking about, which is to take the resources away from a threat that really doesn't exist at the scale that our military spending would reflect. You know, there really aren't any other big superpowers out there that want to threaten us. It just doesn't exist. And having 800 bases or 700 bases around the world is really not lending itself at all to supporting our security. But taking on the question of our failing infrastructure, our inefficient infrastructure, converting it over to what would be modern, energy efficient, meet real people's needs, provide real people with ongoing jobs that can't get outsourced overseas and don't lead to PTSD. I mean, the opportunities to retool our economy to actually meet real needs are just tremendous. And I think the question is going to be, you know, can the American people demand it, and can we force our politicians to give it to us? So I think there's real big opportunities there. On the community scale, you know, I think it's important to also talk about where do our sources of security come from. When we look at, you know, people who are trying to feed their families with food prices going so high, with energy prices, you know, when I think about how people are going to heat their homes this winter and pay for higher food prices and get to work with gasoline prices what they are, you know, I think there's going to be tremendous hardship in a lot of communities, and I think it's more important now than it ever has been, perhaps, for us to really look around and see who else is there in our neighborhood or across town who is going to need some help, and not only extend a helping hand, but ask the question, you know, how do we make our community more sustainable? Where, how do we create long-term jobs? How do we feed ourselves? How do we start taking back, you know, so much of the power and so much of the economy that has gone elsewhere, and saying, you know, we actually can do this in our community. We can create sustainable communities right here. And I think that when you get to that fundamental level of that level of insecurity, you know, just recently there were these two shootings, one of them in a Unitarian church, where some young men who had recently lost their jobs shot liberals because they thought that was who was to blame. I mean, I think there's a story out there about what the reason for your fear and insecurity is. You know, that story is really quite distorted and propagated by a few right-wing nuts. But there's a real story, too, which is that people really are feeling insecure and are feeling, you know, like they may not be able to make it. They may not have, many don't have homes. Many are having trouble feeding their families. We have got to rise to that occasion and figure out in our own communities how are we going to pull together so we can make it through this crisis.
We have about 5 minutes left, so I'd like each of you to just take a look and see what would you like to leave our listeners with today that they can do that would make a difference, that would make an impact. You know, just the key things that we can break it down so we leave here with people actually being in action. David, you want to start?
Okay. Well, first I want to underscore what Sarah just said about all kinds of initiatives to rebuild one's local economies, local food systems, and so forth, which are very much underway. And many initiatives, one I'm involved in is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which is supporting networks all around the U.S. and Canada on this. But the other piece of this, which is perhaps less evident, is once one understands the significance of the power of the cultural stories and how the right wing managed to trapped us into so many of these political dead ends by shaping the stories that frame the political discourse. You know, we need to change those stories. We need to break through that cultural trance, and one of the most powerful ways to do that is through conversation. And I'm very struck that the deepest of changes always has to start with a conversation. And holding conversations in your churches and community groups with your neighbors and so forth around the kinds of possibilities that we're talking about here. And, of course, YES offers an enormous resource for that, for taking these stories and these visions of the world that can be in terms of very major reorientation and engaging in conversation to share those ideas and explore them. So we begin to recognize the extent to which those of us who do embrace those ideas are not alone, that in fact, there's a very major portion of the population that is ready to look at and develop, expand, and commit themselves to advancing a new vision of our human possibility.
Thank you. Dot?
Yes, I would say the number one thing is that peace begins with me, and you started out with that, Michael, and thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to dialogue, and thank you for demonstrating that peace begins with me. We need to do our own work. That's where the real change begins.
Yes,
I would say, secondly, to stay informed and know that every single one of us makes a difference. You make a difference. And thirdly, to eat local and buy local as much as possible, remembering that every dollar that I spend is a vote cast for what I want more of.
Very nice. Thank you. And Sarah?
Yeah, I guess I would underline or endorse what Dot and Dave just said. And I think the thing that I keep coming back to is during a time of crisis, what really makes the difference is whether we pull together or pull apart. You know, if we pull apart, we can have each person out for themselves, people feeling isolated, bunkered down in their houses, trying to figure out how they're going to survive on their own when the foreclosure notices come in or when food gets scarce or whatever happens. And on the other hand, when we pull together, people are extraordinary when they work as a community. You know, they can sandbag a community and keep the floodwaters out. They can help somebody who's sick, and then the next time somebody else is sick, they can help them. And there's a genuine kind of wealth that's generated when we work together and support each other that is not reliant on the global economy. And I think that's what's going to take. And when I talk about working together, I don't mean just with our neighbors, although that's really important, but I also mean with the people who look different than us, so that we aren't divided by race this time. We're not divided by class. We're not divided by all the ways that we are divided now in this country, that we pull together and say, what's really going to work best for the whole? Because I think we can have it. If we make that choice to work together, I think we can actually have it.
I have a very personal and strong belief that the world that we live in is the world that comes out of our mouth. And I want to thank the three of you for being three of the great big mouths on the planet and do it so eloquently. Sarah, your articles touch me deeply when I read your articles, and for all your work with Yes, thank you for your tireless efforts. And David, I love your books and the work you do. It's always a joy to have you on and to talk with you. And Dot, I feel like I've made a new friend here, and I look forward to hearing of your progress and anything that we can do here with Conversations. I want you to know that you have our full support, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Peace train, holy roller, everyone jump.